Well, open your Bible to the book of Esther in your Old Testament. And as you're turning there or navigating there on your phone would be a great way also to follow along. We're going to cover four chapters in Esther today, so you're going to want to have it in front of you. And plus, this is just an incredible story. As we said in the last couple weeks, it is one of the only books of the Bible that doesn't mention God. And when you read it at first, you might even think to yourself, was this a mistake? Was it a mistake that they forgot to put something in there about God or even anything remotely adjacent to God, it seems? Or was it a mistake that it even ended up in the Bible because it doesn't really talk about God and it's not really overtly religious? What are we supposed to make of this? Well, we talked about this last week, but really this all comes to a head in helping us ask what may be the main question that Esther, as a divinely inspired book in our Old Testament, is meant for us to ask, which is this: what is it like to live by faith when you're desperate for God to intervene, but it seems like he's distant or even absent? And maybe the absence of the name God or the religiosity of being a Jew in the Old Testament, the absence of that, maybe not a mistake. Maybe it was intentional to help us get an idea of what it's like to be a person of faith in the midst of a godless culture. Because God's people, in the setting of the book of Esther, are living in exile. They had the opportunity to go back to Jerusalem at this point, but this is a group of people who did not go back to Jerusalem to help rebuild the temple and reestablish life for the Jewish people in Jerusalem, but rather they stayed in Babylon. They stayed in exile, so to speak. Why would they do that? Well, just a quick reminder, a refresher, that this is God's plan for all of his people, not just to huddle in a holy huddle in Jerusalem, but it goes all the way back to Esther's ancestor Abraham, that God's plan for his people was to multiply and to be a blessing to every nation, not just to huddle in their one holy nation. And so Esther is accomplishing God's purpose. The question is how? How are we supposed to accomplish God's purpose when we are in the midst of a godless culture and it may appear that God is absent? Well, before you ask the question, what do I do or how do I do this, I think Esther's posing a question for us that's maybe even more important. It's the question, who am I really? Who am I really? And before we ask, how do we live a life of faith? We have to first answer that question, who am I really? Now, from Esther chapter 4 to Esther chapter 8, I'm going to divide it into kind of two major movements and walk us through it there to help us answer this question, who am I really? Or even learn how to ask this question, who am I really? The first movement, I would say, is defined by these two words. It's the words risk and discernment. Risk and discernment. So let me begin reading for you in chapter 4. While you're looking there, turning there, I'm going to start in verse 10, but let me set this up. If you remember last week, chapter 3 left us with quite a cliffhanger where God's people are destined in an edict made by the king and his associate Haman to be destroyed. In all 120 provinces, from India to Kush, all of God's people have been committed to death. They're not going to survive. And so at the beginning of chapter 4, we see this character Mordecai, this Jewish man whose cousin is Esther, and he's adopted Esther. He's raised Esther as his own when she was orphaned. And then Esther is taken into the king's harem and is eventually named the king's wife. We learn that in chapter 2. Mordecai is in mourning. He's wearing sackcloth, as many of the other Jews are. And when word gets to Esther inside the palace that Mordecai is in mourning, she tries to cover it up. Give him some new clothes. Send Mordecai some new clothes. But Mordecai refuses and thinks maybe Esther doesn't know what's going on. He makes sure that she gets the copy of the edict to understand what's happening to all of her people, even though the king doesn't yet know that Esther is Jewish, thinks she's Persian. She now is entrusted with this information. And Mordecai is commanding her to act. You got to do something about this, Esther. And then Esther replies, and there's a conversation between the two of them with a bit of a mediator, a go-between. And here's what happens in verse 10. Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to tell Mordecai. So this is, hey, right back at you, Mordecai. Verse 11, all the royal officials and the people of the royal provinces know that one law applies to every man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court and who has not been summoned, the death penalty, unless the king extends the golden scepter, allowing that person to live. I've not been summoned to appear before the king for the last 30 days. Esther's response was reported to Mordecai. Basically, Esther's saying, Mordecai, you want me to do something about this, but I'm not sure you quite understand. This could cost me my life. I'm not sure I'm going to go like a bull in a china cabinet to the king and his throne, even though I'm married to him. Marriage was quite a bit different for Esther and the king of Persia, quite a bit different than the marriage you and I have experienced. Even she would be susceptible to this law. There were other people in the court who had better access to the king than she did. And so she's saying, Mordecai, I don't think you understand. Well, go to verse 13. Let's see. Mordecai replies. He tells the messenger to reply to Esther. Don't think that you will escape the fate of all the Jews because you are in the king's palace. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place. But you and your father's family will be destroyed. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and assemble all the Jews who can be found in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my female servants will also fast in the same way. And after that, I will go to the king, even if it's against the law. If I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went and did everything Esther had commanded him. Now, there's just an interesting thing to me here that what begins with Mordecai commanding Esther is then turned on Mordecai, and in maybe quite a countercultural way, Esther then commands Mordecai, and Mordecai follows through. He supports Esther. That's something beautiful we see in their relationship as he's taken care and concern for Esther, and he's got the courage to do that. And so Mordecai goes and does everything Esther has commanded him. Let's just pause right there. Now, there's a tendency here just to rush into Esther and her story of courage. Esther's the hero. Esther steps up. She takes the reins. But I just want you to pay close attention briefly to what Mordecai does here and see Mordecai in context. Mordecai, even though he's in mourning, is able to communicate with Esther, and he communicates something to Esther that's a reminder to us that we need to be constantly reminded of through the Bible, and that is that God is providential, that God works through all things to accomplish his purpose. He says, Esther, look, you're destined for death, just like the rest of it. It's going to come upon you as well, but maybe you're in this position for such a time as this. By the way, if you don't say anything, God's going to provide relief and deliverance for his people. In some form or fashion, it will happen. But how will it happen is the question. And often we don't know. If you think back a couple years ago, we studied the book of Genesis. And I mentioned Esther and Mordecai's ancestor, Abraham. And for about a third of the book of Genesis, what we see is Abraham, who we consider like a hero of the faith, is just almost wishy-washy, like believing God's going to accomplish his purposes through him and his family. And then the very next chapter, it'd be like, how's God going to do this? I don't believe he's going to accomplish his purpose, so I'm going to take it into my own hands. I'm going to accomplish things my own way. And we see this back and forth, back and forth. And interestingly enough, here in Esther, Mordecai keeps a faith that even in Genesis, Abraham often failed to keep, trusting that God won't let his people be annihilated. Mordecai then suggests to Esther that nothing in her story has been accidental or random, but all is meant to be redeemed by God in his providential care and concern for the world, not just for his people. But God is up to something so much bigger. Through his people, he will not fail. And this is a good message for us too. We've got to remember that God is providential. This morning I was talking with someone just in the hallway about happy providences and unhappy providences. There are things that's providential for us that we go, wow, that was great. We loved that. Let's have more of that, God. But then sometimes we go through things that are maybe a little less happy or a lot less happy. Yeah, we've talked about it before, but as God's sovereign hand moves over history, accomplishing his purposes, that sometimes we find ourselves in the shadow. And what seems like darkness to us is actually part in some beautiful way, in some unknown mysterious way to us, of God's bigger plans and purposes. And so we trust that he's at work in all things, even in the pieces and parts of our own stories that seem accidental or random or unwelcome. God can work through all of this. This is a good reminder for us. But I want to point you to something about Esther here that I find just very unique and that has some application for us today. Esther, if you go back to chapter 2 and remember when she was introduced to us, is the only person in the entire book who has two names. Do you remember? She's given, introduced as her Hebrew name and then also with her Persian name. And what I might suggest, as others have suggested, is that Esther is wrestling between two identities in this moment. Often we see Esther as kind of the superhero of the story, that maybe what's happening here is that she's just a mild-mannered alter ego in the king's harem, and she's just waiting for her moment to jump in the telephone booth and pull off her royal robe and then reveal her superhero costume and go save the day for the Jews, right? That's kind of how we sometimes think of Esther. But that's not actually what's happening. Instead, she does have two identities, but they're two identities that are living in tension. It's a tension we often feel too. It's the gravitational force between the temporary home we currently experience and the eternal home that we know we're destined to live in. And we feel a pull in both directions, and Esther feels this pull too. Can I just keep to myself and stay among the king's harem and accomplish just, you know, maybe it's survival for myself? Or must I reveal my true identity and go to bat for God and for his people? And she feels this tension. And in chapter 4, we see her coming to this point where she finally embraces her true identity as one of God's people. Esther was forced to answer the question, who am I really? And that's the question you and I have to answer too. Who am I really? Because to be used in God's plan, his eternal plan of the redemption of all things, involves identifying with him. Esther's true identity isn't actually revealed until chapter 7. But she chooses to engage in fasting here. And some people have kind of inserted prayer into this. I'm not sure we even have to. It's just she starts to do something that may be familiar to Persians in terms of fasting, but it's also part of Jewish culture in terms of fasting. But either way, she's making an effort to embrace her identity as one of God's people and lean into what God might want to use her to do. Because perhaps she's come to this position for such a time as this. We don't know yet. Let's find out. Because chapter 4 leaves us again with another cliffhanger, just like chapter 3. This time, it's what will happen to Esther. What will happen? Let's read in chapter 5, the first couple of verses here. First few verses says, on the third day, so she said, we're going to fast for 3 days and nights, right? No food or drink. So chapter 5, on the third day, Esther dressed in her royal clothing and stood in the inner courtyard of the palace facing it. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the royal courtroom facing its entrance. So we know something's about to happen. As soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she gained favor in his eyes. The king extended the gold scepter in his hand toward Esther, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. What is it, Queen Esther? The king asked her. Whatever you want, even to half the kingdom, will be given to you. Now, this is the moment, right? This is all, she's been invited in, up to half the kingdom. All she has to do is say, King, my people are in danger. Will you rescue them? But she doesn't. And we don't really get the answer why she doesn't right then. But if I could just kind of summarize what happens, she invites the king, and this is her request, and what she asks of the king is she invites the king and Haman to come to a banquet that she's prepared to them. She's going to wine and dine them. And she does. And at the party, at the banquet, which is a theme in Esther, the king says again, okay, Esther, you didn't come to me for nothing. What is it that you want? What's your request? I'll give you anything up to half the kingdom. And again, she chooses not to ask for what she really knows she's after. But she says, if you could do this for me, tomorrow we're going to have another banquet, and come and join me at that banquet, and there I'll do what you've asked and present my request to you. So Haman leaves that first party. He's in good spirits. You remember Haman was the evil associate of the king who convinces the king to put the edict in motion to kill all the Jewish people. And so here he is with Esther and with the king at these banquets, and she says, one more day, come back tomorrow. Well, Haman goes home. He's had a great time at the party. He's looking forward to the next day. He's thinking, there's no one else in Persia like me. I'm second to the king. I'm invited with the queen to the banquet 2 days in a row. Look at me. This is awesome. And he walks outside of the palace, and he comes across Mordecai, Esther's cousin. Mordecai, who was the impetus originally for this edict to kill all the Jews. And why? It's because Mordecai refused to pay homage to him, refused to bow down to him. Well, guess what? In chapter 5, it happens again. He walks by, and there is Mordecai, other people paying homage to Haman. Oh, how great Haman is. And Mordecai just stands there and refuses. And that sends Haman into a rage. So he goes home. What am I going to do? What am I going to do about this? And his wife and all of his friends tell him, get rid of Mordecai. It's time. Yes, we know there's an edict. All the Jewish people are going to be annihilated, but this one needs to be annihilated now. And so build a gallows 75 feet tall for him to be hanged on tomorrow. We're going to come back to this piece of the story here in a minute. But I want to just dig in for just a second about this question, who am I really? And talk about Esther's strategy here. Because Esther's not hasty. She's not defiant to the king and his edict. She must certainly have felt some sort of fear about her own fate, especially as she goes and stands in the courtyard before the king. She probably felt some fear about the fate of her people and if she would be found out, but she yet seems to operate with discernment. She's taking a massive risk, yet then when this risk is proven to be the right risk to take, she then operates with discernment. Now, for you kiddos out there, discernment is like spiritual spidey senses, okay? This is where, like, she just has an awareness, probably given by God, that we can't necessarily know exactly how or why she decided what she's doing, but we know she's making an intentional decision here to delay the ask. Maybe she knew. Maybe she knew the king needed to be kind of teased out like a fisherman who lets the fish grab the bait and run with the line a little bit before setting the hook. We don't know. Maybe Esther just wanted to create some space to see what God would do. Would he show up? Would he intervene? Ian Duguid is an author, a commentator who suggests that even if they were unaware, Esther's subtlety and Mordecai's stubbornness in refusing to pay homage to Haman were actually employed by God's sovereignty to bring about the result that happens. And so pay close attention to Esther here, because the important application for us is not how did Esther do it, but what did Esther choose was her true identity. And there's something really cool that happens in this chapter. Up until chapter 5, Esther was just Esther. Even though she had buried the king in Esther chapter 2, it takes until chapter 5, it takes until actually she embraces her true identity as one of God's people and is willing to be exposed as one of God's people before she's ever referred to by the king as Queen Esther. What's happening here? I think that ultimately what's happening is that her embrace of her true identity as a Hebrew is what seems to unlock her ability to be a blessing, not just to her people, but to all the Persians. And as we read through the end of Esther and this week and next, that's what we're going to see, is Esther becomes a blessing to all the Persians. And I believe it started when she made the decision to embrace her true identity regardless of the cost. And as it turns out, as we said before, she gets to live into her true identity, which is to be a blessing to all nations, just like God promised Abraham he and his descendants would be. This is what becomes, as one writer calls, a defining moment in Esther's life, where she begins to grow into her true identity. And as I say, is able to live in Babylon, but not of Babylon. And that's the tension. Right? That's the tension that we all live in. That's even addressed in the New Testament, that we would be people who live in the world but are not of the world. That's what's exactly what's happening in Esther's life is am I the Persian queen or am I God's servant? And could it be that God has placed me as the Persian king so that I can live as his servant and not of Persia but in Persia, accomplishing his purpose and influencing not just a small group of people but ultimately the world? Could it be? You and I face these same kind of defining moments. One of the major defining moments where we have to decide who am I really is when we're confronted with the gospel of Jesus Christ. When we hear the good news that Jesus came to earth, God's son, to live a perfect life, to die a death he didn't deserve on a Roman cross, was buried in a tomb for 3 days, and then miraculously rose from the dead, conquering death, appearing to all kinds of people before he ascended to heaven and assumed his rightful position at the right hand of God, we're confronted with this reality that we are sinners who cannot stand in the presence of a holy God without a mediator, and that Jesus is the mediator who makes a way for us to be reunited with God when there was no other way. We're confronted with this reality. We have to decide, who am I really? Will I choose to be Jesus's? Will I choose to be united with God in faith? Or will I choose to live my pagan lifestyle? We have other defining moments. We have opportunities then. Maybe you just made that decision to trust Jesus by faith, to become his. He adopts you as his God's son or daughter. He makes you one with Christ in faith. And you have the opportunity, then a defining moment is, are you going to identify with him publicly through baptism? That's a great next step. After you become a Christian, will you do it? Will you publicly identify with him? And then it goes on. I mean, we have more opportunities, as Colossians talks about, to put off the old self and put on the new self, right? Or we have other things like, are we going to be the kind of people who say, I'm God's regardless of the cost, and so I'm willing to start spiritual conversations with people that I otherwise would not have been willing to have a spiritual conversation with? Am I willing to invite someone to faith in Jesus that I might not have otherwise wanted to talk about that with? Maybe it's even closer to home if we said, is God calling you to missions or to ministry? And this is a defining moment where you go, who am I really? And if I'm God's, am I willing to give my life for whatever he asks me to do so that I can be a blessing to the world and accomplish his purposes of redemption? Defining moments happen every day. They're not just these big, huge moments like who am I going to marry or what school am I going to choose or what job am I going to take. They're not just, it's also like daily obedience. These things are defining moments every day. Like, what am I going to do when temptation comes my way? Who am I really? Am I God's or am I my own? That's the question. Esther begins to live into her true identity. Mordecai, embracing his true identity. And we see, just like Esther and Mordecai, that nothing in our stories are accidental. Nothing is random. It's all able to be redeemed by God. But the reality is that we must embrace our true identity as God's people if we're going to live for God's purpose and see his redemption come about in our lives and through our lives. And so in this chapter, chapter 4, we see a beautiful marriage of divine providence and of human responsibility. See, Esther and Mordecai, though, they didn't have the advantage of this perspective that we have. Like, it's kind of easy for us to look back on the story of Esther and go, oh yeah, it's God's providence. Oh yeah, look how God was at work in all these little ways. They didn't necessarily have that perspective, and in our own defining moments, often we don't have that perspective either. When you get a diagnosis that you didn't expect, when a relationship falls apart that you never saw coming, when you lose a job, when the market crashes, whatever it is, we have these moments of who am I really? And none of it happens by chance. And in all of it, we have an opportunity to be part of the redemptive work of God in the world. But we must embrace our true identity as being one of God's people. Esther and Mordecai didn't have the advantage of that perspective, and often we don't either. When we realize we're in one of these defining moments, let me just present to you that there are options for you. You can be like Daniel, if you remember the book of Daniel. And when things are maybe against God's people, you might be one who, like Daniel, stands in opposition and is direct in opposition. You could even think of the word protest when it comes to the story of Daniel. But sometimes the opportunity you have to be part of God's redemptive purpose doesn't look like protest. Sometimes it looks more like Esther, and influencing our world in a more discerning way, which could be used, you could use the word process. It's not as in your face. But the Bible seems to present both of these things as options for us. It's like, how do we live out the faith? Once we've embraced our true identity as God's people, is yes, we could go stand on the street and yell at people through a megaphone. Yes, we can hold signs in a yard on the roadside, or we could also get involved in public policy. We can get on the school boards. We can go and meet with our teachers. We can go and talk to our boss who offended us. In all these ways, we can be part of God's redemptive process in the world. And all of it can be used and redeemed by him. The point is, though, that we cannot remain neutral. We can't remain neutral. Let me say it another way. God is less concerned with what clothes you wear, whether it's the sackcloth of Mordecai or the royal robes of Esther, but he's very concerned with how you wear them to be part of his purposes. This is the walk of faith. This is everyday choices and defining moments that we get to live to be part of God's plan. And it always involves risk to identify with God. Esther says, if I perish, I perish. But if we take Esther's resolve in this moment and we add the gospel perspective, we actually can kind of tweak that phrase into something more beautiful. Jesus did this for us, by the way. John chapter 11, Jesus is encouraging his friend who lost their brother Lazarus. And what this friend doesn't quite know is that Jesus is about to go raise Lazarus from the dead. But what he says to her is this: I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even though he dies, will live. So the gospel perspective, once we know whose we really are and that we're going to live as part of God's redemptive purposes in the world, being a blessing to all people, is that even if it costs me my life, yes, I die, but I also live. And that is the resolve that Jesus calls us to. Church, we're living in a cultural defining moment. I don't know if you realize this, where it appears as if adversity to the faith is at an all-time high. Now, I mean, if you look at the whole world, the global picture of Christianity, that may not be true. But man, right here where we are in our context, it can look like when you turn on the news that adversity to Jesus Christ is at an all-time high. But I just want to give you a little word of encouragement, but that there's another perspective on that. And that if you're looking the right places, what you're going to find is that there is a generation of young people who are hungry for the things of God and who are willing to take bold stands for Jesus and who are leading the way in the development of Christianity here in America and especially in the South. And this is just an encouragement to you that yes, you might turn on one news channel and get one message that looks like, boy, the world is against us. Can I just tell you that God is still at work and that God is moving, and especially in the generation that is coming up, the Gen Zers, right? These guys are leading the way in being a blessing to the world because of faith in Jesus Christ. They're answering the question with confidence, who am I really? And it's fun to watch and it's fun to be a part of. It's one of the huge blessings of like having a church that it has all generations in it. And I just tell you, like all generations that are in the room, you matter. But this is a moment where I think we can look to our younger brothers and sisters in Christ and let them lead us. And I used to just put myself in the young category, like less and less am I doing that these days. It's time to let them lead us. And they are choosing Jesus, and it's beautiful to watch. But I wonder in your life, what does God want you to be more public about or bold about in your faith? When you answer the question, who am I really? Is your answer confidently, I am God's, and I want to live for his purposes regardless of the cost? It's a good question to ask. Esther and Mordecai's boldness led to, with God's sovereign hand at work, great reward. In fact, this is what happens in chapters 6-8. This movement can be defined with the two words, relief and deliverance. Do you remember how Mordecai said this to Esther? If you don't stand up, relief and deliverance will come in another way. God is going to do something here. Well, guess what? When Esther stands up, God does something with her and through her. And it's really cool to watch. In fact, there's some real irony in the story that makes this just a great story. But if you look in chapter 6, I just want to read a couple sections from chapter 6-8 for you so that you get an idea of what's happening here. So just start with me in chapter 6, verse 1. This is the night after that first party, anticipating the next party. Haman's gone home happy, then he gets furious because Mordecai refuses to bow down. He goes and his wife says to build the gallows, you're going to hang Mordecai tomorrow, it's going to be great for you, you're going to be fine. Well, that night, something totally out of the control of Esther and out of the control of Mordecai, out of the control of Haman, something totally out of the control happens. That night, sleep escaped the king. So he ordered the book recording daily events to be brought and read to the king. Wouldn't you like to just have someone come read to you at night? That'd be nice to help you go to sleep. They found the written report of how Mordecai had informed on Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the entrance when they planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. And the king inquired, what honor and special recognition has been given to Mordecai for this act? Mind you, this is 5 years later. 5 years later. On this particular night, the king cannot sleep and asks for this book, and this particular story is read to him about Mordecai. And the king's personal attendants replied, nothing has been done for him. The king asked, who's in the court? Is there anyone out there hanging around? Now, Haman was just entering the outer court of the palace to ask the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows he had prepared for him. And the king's attendants answered, Haman's there, standing in the court. Look what happens. Have him enter, the king ordered. Haman entered, and the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king wants to honor? Oh, Haman and his pride. Haman thought to himself, who is it that the king would want to honor more than me? So Haman tells the king, for the man the king wants to honor, have them bring a royal garment and the king himself has worn, and a horse the king himself has ridden, which has a royal crown on its head. Put the garment and the horse under the charge of one of the king's most noble officials. Have them clothe the man and the king wants to honor. Parade him on the horse through the city square and proclaim before him, this is what is done for the man the king wants to honor. And the king tells Haman, hurry, do just as you proposed. Take a garment and a horse for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not leave anything out you have suggested. Oh, Haman, how the tables have turned. Wow. What was going on here? Well, Haman's thinking to himself that, boy, I'm about to be sitting pretty. I'm about to have some good stuff going on. I mean, this would be like the equivalent of putting on Michael Jordan's game-worn jersey and then slipping on the championship ring and some game-worn shoes and thinking, I'm about to dunk. But none of us could do that. And we would just put on the jersey and the shoes and the championship ring. It doesn't make us into Michael Jordan, but Haman is thinking, like, this is my chance, and if maybe I can be like the king, people will see me as if I'm a king. And here's what's crazy to me. If you go back to chapter 5, verse 13, which we didn't read, here he is. He's reeling with even all this good stuff that's happened. He says, still none of this satisfies me since I see Mordecai sitting at the king's gate all the time. Can I just tell you, I don't think Haman would have been satisfied with being paraded around in the king's court with the king's horse wearing the king's robe. I think eventually Haman would have gone after the king himself, because that's what pride does. Pride never is satisfied. But he has to swallow it and parade Mordecai, his arch enemy, around in the king's clothes, on the king's horse, in the king's court. Haman is humiliated. His plot is foiled. If you look at verse 12 through 14, what happens is even his advisors kind of turn on him and tell him the reality of his situation. It says, then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried off for home, mournful and with his head covered. Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai is Jewish, and you have begun to fall before him, you won't overcome him because your downfall is certain. And while they were still speaking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and rushed Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. Maybe you see these things all coming to a head. They are. But in chapter 6, what we saw is relief came for Mordecai. In a very ironic and providential way, but it came for Mordecai to be relieved from Haman's anger and rage. And then Haman's humiliated, and in chapter 7, we see relief come for Esther. Chapter 7, verse 1, says this, the king and Haman came to feast with Esther the queen. Once again, on the second day, while drinking wine, the king asked Esther, Queen Esther, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you seek, even to half the kingdom, will be done. Queen Esther answered, if I've found favor in your eyes, your majesty, and if the king is pleased, here it is, spare my life. This is my request. And spare my people. This is my desire. For my people and I have been sold to destruction, death, and extermination. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I'd have kept silent. Indeed, the trouble wouldn't be worth burdening the king. King Ahasuerus spoke up, asked Queen Esther, who is this and where is the one who would devise such a scheme? Maybe completely forgetting that he was part of this scheme in allowing it to happen. And Esther answered, the adversary and enemy is this evil Haman. Haman stood terrified before the king and queen. You know, he's already been emasculated with the Mordecai situation. Verse 7, the king arose in anger, went from where they were drinking wine to the palace garden. Note now that Haman and Esther are the only two left in the room. Haman remained to beg Queen Esther for his life because he realized the king was planning something terrible for him. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. And the king exclaimed, "Would he actually violate the queen while I'm in the house?" As soon as the statement left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, "There's a gallows 75 feet tall at Haman's house that he made for Mordecai, who gave the report that saved the king." And the king says, "Hang him on it." They hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's anger subsided. We've got some incredible irony happening here against Haman. And relief is come for Mordecai and Esther. And deliverance is now coming for God's people. Let's just continue and read on chapter 8. It says, "That same day, King Ahasuerus awarded Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. Mordecai entered the king's presence because Esther had revealed her relationship to Mordecai. The king removed his signet ring he had recovered from Haman and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther put him in charge of Haman's estate. Then Esther addressed the king again. She fell at his feet, wept, and begged him to revoke the evil of Haman the Agagite and his plot he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the gold scepter toward Esther, so she got up and stood before the king. She said, 'If it pleases the king, if I've found favor before him, if the matter seems right to the king and I am pleasing in his eyes, let a royal edict be written. Let it revoke the documents the scheming Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how could I bear to see the disaster that would come on my people? How could I bear to see the destruction of my relatives?' King Ahasuerus said to Esther the queen and to Mordecai the Jew, 'Look, I've given Haman's estate to Esther, and he was hanged on the gallows because he attacked the Jews. Write the king's name, in the king's name, whatever pleases you concerning the Jews, and seal it with the royal signet ring. A document written in the king's name and sealed with the royal signet ring cannot be revoked.'" And so that's what Esther and Mordecai do. They write the document freeing the Jewish people from the genocide that's about to happen to them. And they send that document on the fastest horses out to all the provinces to get the news out. And they actually give, in this incredible way, the authority to the Jewish people to defend themselves. And it just really just parallels with something that God's already taught his people in Deuteronomy chapter 20 about how to defend yourself. And it's an incredible story that the Jewish people are able to defend themselves effectively. And as the issue, the copy of the text is issued and it goes out through all the provinces, more happens to Mordecai. It says in verse 15 of chapter 8, "Mordecai went from the king's presence clothed in royal purple and white, with a great gold crown and a purple robe of fine linen. The city of Susa shouted and rejoiced, and the Jews celebrated with gladness, joy, and honor. In every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his law reached, joy and rejoicing took place among the Jews. There was a celebration and a holiday, and many of the ethnic groups of the land professed themselves to be Jews because fear of the Jews had overcome them." So now God's people, embracing their true identity, risking their lives, employing the discernment that God's given them to be operatives and agents of his redemption in the world, to be a blessing to all nations, whatever the cost, even personal lives and livelihood, are now elevated to this place of royal honor in Persia so that the blessing can extend even farther of God's people to all nations. This is what God does for the people who answer the question, "Whose am I really? I am God's. Even if it costs me my life." This teaches us to embrace the reality of our eternal story. See, Esther can kind of be divided into three sections, maybe. The first section kind of describes the crisis of the Jewish people. That's chapters 1 through 3. This section that we've kind of seen today describes the courage God's people to say, I'm God's and I'm going to live in my true identity and be a blessing to the world. Next week, we're going to see how celebration is the key to holding on to hope and carrying the torch of faith from generation to generation. But for now, what we see is God provides relief and deliverance through his people, not just for his people, but through his people who are willing to say, I am God's. That is who I really am. And I'm going to live for him. When we zoom out, there's just one more thing that I want to show you, because it's probably what matters more than anything. If you zoom out in Esther, if you zoom out in the Bible, if you zoom out in all eternity, the two words that describe what's going to ultimately happen is redemption and destiny. And these are the two absolute truths that the book of Esther points us to, is that number one, God is always at work in every detail of history, bringing about the fulfillment of his promise to redeem sinful humanity and restore all things to himself. Here's how we said it last week, that God is present and faithful even when we can't see him or hear him. You may not see the author of the story, right? But you can trust he's the one writing it. The second thing we see is that Esther proves that God is always at work in every detail of your life and my life, inviting us to participate in his redemptive story. That we said it this way last week, God's people are called. As God is always present and faithful, God's people are called to be a faithful presence, even in a pagan culture, even in a godless culture. But we can't zoom straight from Esther's story to our story without going through the cross, without growing through Jesus. And we've got to ask the question, because we read the Bible in light of every other aspect of the Bible. How does Esther's story point us to Jesus? How does Esther's story point us to the gospel? Did you notice that we have a king in Ahasuerus whom no one can stand before apart from his grace and mercy? Well, does that not point us to a better king? Whom, yes, no one can stand before apart from his grace and mercy, but a better king, a true king of eternity, who does not just extend a scepter to welcome one, but extends through the cross of Jesus Christ an invitation for all to freely come to him by his grace. Did you notice that we have a people destined for death apart from the intervention of a mediator in Esther? Andrew Aber over on Longview campus says this. He says, as Israel's representative, Esther received favor and her people were saved. As our representative, Jesus received God's wrath so we could receive God's favor. We as sinful humans are destined for death apart from a mediator. Jesus is our mediator and continues to operate at the right hand of God as our advocate. Did you notice that there was an adversary who plotted death for another, who then had the tables turned on him? And does that not remind you of an even better victory that happened, that what the enemy designed for the death of God's representative became the tool for his own demise? This reminds me of Genesis 3, that the serpent who strikes the heel of God's seed will then have his head crushed. Or maybe reminds you of Jesus, who did not escape death, but endured the cross on our behalf and on behalf of all of his people, and then rose from the grave, conquering death, so that the cross became not just what killed Jesus, but it came the death blow to Satan himself and all of his purposes. Did you notice that those who conquered death in the story of Esther through faithful obedience are the ones who ultimately received the crown? That we have a better destiny. That because Jesus endured death, conquered in resurrection power, and is now seated at the right hand of God and taking his rightful place as the King of Kings, that we can trust that even though our story may pass through suffering, it never ends at suffering, because we have a resurrection awaiting us. We live by faith, participating in God's story of redemption to be a blessing to others, to the entire world. This is our purpose. This is why we're here. And even if it costs us our life, we have the promise of resurrection. And we look forward to the time, as we just studied in the end of the book of Revelation, when God returns to make all things right and all things new. And what will be our destiny but to reign with Christ? A royal position, just like Mordecai, just like Esther. This is the story that God is calling you to today. And so when you ask the question of yourself, who am I really? The answer that's beckoning you is to say, I am Jesus's. That I'll give my life to him in faith because he gave his life for me on the cross for the forgiveness of my sin so that I can be one with God again and part of this bigger story that God is at work accomplishing. I want to lead us in prayer today, and if that's something you're thinking about today, that God is calling me to say yes to Jesus, to identify with him, then I just want to give you some words that you might pray in your own heart today. And then we'll just have a minute to let this truth sink in. But let me lead us in this prayer. And if that's you, if you want to know, if you want Jesus to be your Savior, if you want to identify with him, you want to be God's, this is maybe how you could pray. God, I'm not proud of the parts of my story that are offensive to you. But I'm grateful that you offer forgiveness through Jesus Christ. And I believe that Jesus' death on the cross is what makes it possible for me to have forgiveness and to receive eternal life. So God, I just want to say yes to Jesus today. I want to commit my life to Jesus in faith, to stop living for myself and to start living for him. Thank you, God, that you promise that those who call on you will be saved. And I believe you're saving me. God, help me know what's next. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.